You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, With Love, Sean Combs, by Tressie McMillan Cottom. We have the internet. We have the power. We have a culture. I have us on a five-year plan. That plan is for black people, although Combs is careful to say that he loves everyone. He says many times during our talk that love is about moving from me to we, and he has a very clear idea of who is included in that we. My people, taking time to feel like it's all right to love. Take time to huddle up your tribe. Take time to communicate and know your power. Take time to heal. You know what I'm saying. Taking care of yourself without feeling like, oh, you're going to be labeled a racist now because you talk about taking care of yourself. He is on a roll. This isn't the black preacher elegy. It has more fury and a faster cadence. It's like a taut hip-hop verse. Combs wants to model what loving oneself can do for collective black action. In the wake of hashtag MeToo and Black Lives Matter, Combs went looking for guidance. He jumps up during his recitation on black love to retrieve a small journal. It looks out of place in the home's curated opulence. The tan embossed cover has a tiny lock, like a teenager's first diary. The unlined pages have quotes written on them in large block letters. Combs flips to the first page. It is a James Baldwin quote. Love does not begin and end the way we seem to think it does. Love is a battle. Love is a war. Love is a growing up. Growing up, for Combs, has meant coming back to God. Diddy had gotten so far from God, Combs tells me. He had hunger and vision, but it was so small. Now, Combs believes he is stepping into his purpose. It clicked in and went from me to we, that I was sent here not just to do those things that are kind of rooted in personal success, but to be able to transfer to we and do things that are real change and communal success. He drops the journal on the table as he tells me this. The wind catches the pages to reveal that most of them are blank, as if he has only started to figure this thing out. That made me wonder, who is guiding Combs's growth in his love era? I feel like God sent me. God, put on my heart, what's your purpose? I was looking at all these things. It's preachers and just different people talking about purpose. Because I was like, man, purpose is something deep. Have I really found my purpose? I know I'm making money and I'm successful and I'm changing the game, so-called, but is that my purpose? And then I really prayed on it and God told me, your purpose is to play a part in saving the black race. And then I was like, I need to talk to Harry Belafonte. Harry Belafonte was Martin Luther King Jr.'s confidant and is a bona fide celebrity. Belafonte used his celebrity status to raise money for civil rights actions and organizations. He has been vocal about his disillusionment with modern celebrities' lack of social responsibility, especially among black celebrities. Belafonte's 2012 comments that high-profile artists have turned their back on social responsibility, called Combs's peer Jay-Z out by name. Belafonte and Jay-Z have since reconciled their public differences. The critique could just have easily been lobbed at Combs, or rather at Puff Daddy and Diddy. He does not name this critique directly, but Combs seems aware of Belafonte's penchant for critique. That is, in part, why Combs called Belafonte when God spoke to him about his purpose. Combs says Belafonte was a model for the kind of activism he envisions for this next stage of his public life. I was like, we were in similar situations, you know what I'm saying? Coming from where we were having a position of power, being celebrities, and I was wondering, how did Belafonte get so dug into social action and really dedicating his life? He has always been dedicated to something, but whereas young Combs's dedication was to family, friends, and making enough money to buy the kind of freedom he felt like the world was denying him, the elder Combs is dedicated to making that freedom possible for others. He says he looked through history and at his own biography during his journey to the Love Era. In that excavation, he saw the makings of someone destined to save his people. The person that was able to go and do Bad Boy, if he's in charge of bringing us together, it sounds like that's the right MF. I believe Combs. I also believe the women in church who say God told them someone else's man is their husband. If they like it, then I love it. Still, if I could ask the women in church one thing, it would be the same thing I tried to ask Combs with little success. I believe God told you that you have been chosen, but did he tell everyone else? Sean Love Combs is a man standing at the crossroads of several sea changes. He is a not-so-young man whose legitimacy as a cultural icon hinges on his power to gatekeep youth culture. The influencer culture has taken the prototypes that Combs helped innovate and mixed commerce with social consciousness. It is no longer enough to look slick or create the newest dance. Today's celebrity has to have a position on climate change, white supremacy, LGBTQ+ equality, and politics. Combs is also a girl dad. He has 6 children, 3 of whom are 14-year-old girls at the time we speak. He wants his daughters to inherit the keys to his kingdom in equal parts with his 3 sons. Raising a trio of girl bosses tunes a dad into the hashtag MeToo movement. Combs is looking back at the international playboy of his youth and a near future where his daughters become young women. And above all, Combs is trying to do the brand iteration that made him successful in a climate that is openly hostile to what his brand represents. Combs's black excellence is, in practice, a celebration of black capitalism. And, if you have not noticed, a lot of people have labeled capitalism as enemy number one. It is a cultural high wire, perhaps too thin for a diddy bop. That won't stop Combs from trying. He launched a diversity training program with a powerful endeavor this summer. The 6-week course is dubbed in true Combs fashion the Excellence Program and is designed to support aspiring entertainment executives hailing from underrepresented communities. It comes at a time when the entertainment agency model has come under fire for its lack of racial diversity. It is part of Combs' desire to use his platform for collective good, but his understanding of what constitutes good may be at odds with the communities from whom he draws some of his inspiration. In the spring of 2021, Combs published an open letter to corporate America in which he demanded that companies increase their spending with black-owned media businesses, saying that incremental progress in ad spend parity is unacceptable. Combs sees himself as advocating for the black consumer in the "If you love us, pay us" missive, but critics were quick to say his call-out was hypocritical, in part because Combs owns Revolt, a cable TV network that courts advertising dollars. Rapper No Name is the kind of artist who would have been difficult to imagine in Puff Daddy's heyday. No Name is a fiercely independent rapper who, along with other contemporary artists like Chance the Rapper, rebuffs the traditional record label deal as both an artistic and political statement. Former Bad Boy artist The LOX and Mays have publicly criticized Combs for trapping them in what they felt were unfair deals in the past. Black capitalism, No Name alleges, would have one celebrate Combs' individual success as social progress. She said on Twitter that Combs was shaming white corporations for a capitalist business model he almost completely replicated. This is not an isolated critique. It is a generational one. Younger audiences are rejecting uncritical boosterism of capitalism. And in a wider swath across pop culture, consumers are demonstrating a willingness to demand more from their parasocial besties. That instinct is quite strong among young black audiences, many of whom participated in Black Lives Matter protests over the last 2 years. Hip-hop artists can still make a song like Party and Bullshit, for sure, but they cannot make it without the audiences pushing back on whether the bullshit was consensual and if the party had a purpose. For his part, Combs tells me that he is not worried about bringing along those who disagree with him. I can't get caught up in that. I know where my heart is at, and you can't just do it alone with just black people. You got to have all types of allies. And that's one thing I'm good at. I'm good at being a unifier, but I'm not going to be in a room with other tribes that protect themselves and make sure that they straight and not make sure that we straight. But also, I'm not a politician. I'm not trying to be the king or the dictator of somebody. I'm a boy from Harlem that came here to make a change. We all have our story. Combs' story is a Hood Horatio Alger tale. He started from the bottom, and now he is here, as it were. It was a hero's tale that made sense for where the culture was in 1999, even where it was in 2005. The 15 years before the 2008 Great Recession were a period of unbridled economic optimism. It was the era of the hustle, and black youth culture translated it into an ethos, an identity, and an ideology. Lester Spence is a professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. In his book on black neoliberalism, he calls this hip-hop ethos the can't-knock-the-hustle mythology of modern black capitalism. That myth made sense in the year 2000, when black America, in particular, was battling the war on drugs by extracting every ounce of opportunity from Bill Clinton's expanding economy. Before financial bubbles started bursting in rapid succession in the 2000s, hustling felt democratic. Anyone with the right dream and the right grind could make it out of the hood, sometimes literally, but usually metaphorically. In 2021, hustling doesn't sound fun. It sounds like the drudgery it is, a set of coping responses to a hostile social order that has left millions of people behind. That kind of moment requires a different kind of story, and maybe a different kind of storyteller. It isn't that the hustle is dead, but that valorization of the hustle culture is surely on the ropes. Hip-hop's core constituency wants to debate the veracity of hustling when predatory mortgages, student loan debt, rising rent, flat wages, and surveillance police states choke the very life out of black lives, black hopes, and black hustle. Combs speaks reverently about Black Lives Matter, calling it part of the Black Renaissance and very much a part of the Love Era. The biggest challenge to the Love Era is the death of the black capitalism joie de vivre that produced Diddy's first two acts. That doesn't worry Combs. He thinks the revolution is foretold, and his place in it has already been written by God. He is more worried that we have talked so much about serious stuff that we forgot to have fun. Fun is Combs' real bag, and he doesn't want audiences to forget that. Above all, love is supposed to feel good. God didn't just give him a purpose. God also brought Combs into alignment with his highest frequency. The fun part is the frequency, he exclaims. The fun part of the love era is the music, the beat, the style, the rhythm, the walk, the talk, the fashion, the joy, the travels, the places we have never been before. As we are winding down our time together, Combs keeps returning to the frequency. He wants to create a vibe for the world to groove to. He invites me back for a soul food Sunday brunch, calling it an example of the love era frequency he is all about creating. He emphasizes that the soul food is healthy and the vibe is next level. He looks pointedly at the recorder that has been between us all day, always part of his awareness. I'm coming back into music, you know. The room pauses for a dramatic beat. Combs obviously wants this on the record, and it is also clearly news to his team. Ever in control of his narrative, he issues the final word by telling me that he is starting a new record label. It will be an all R&B label, because that is the music that makes Love Combs happy. As his publicist looks alarmed at the unplanned disclosure, Combs tells me R&B is where he started. It is time that he comes home, not just for himself, but for the culture. Yeah, all R&B label, because I feel like R&B was abandoned, and it's a part of our African-American culture. And I'm not signing any artist, because if you know better, you do better. I'm doing 50-50 partnerships with pure transparency. That's the thing. The new label is so that we can own the genre. We don't own hip-hop right now. We have a chance to, and I'm going to make sure that we own R&B. And there's the crux of Sean Combs, the man and the culture maker. He believes winning is his birthright, and he wants to share that with the world. It has worked before, and Combs is betting that he can make it work again. To hear him tell it, all we need is love. postcards from the edge. The crucible in which our corrosive politics was forged has a name, and it is Florida. By Joe Hagen, with photographs by Bruce Gilden. Opening photograph shows the ocean with palm trees and a close-up of Roger Stone. Tabloid state, over decades, Roger Stone helped turn Florida into a paragon of the American right. Next photo, Swamplandia. Trump supporters are flocking to Florida. It's late afternoon, and the palms of Fort Lauderdale are swaying as Roger Stone, dirty trickster, convicted felon, glides across the boulevard in short sleeves and a linen jacket, ready for his first cocktail of the day. We're approaching the Elbow Room, a decrepit party bar on the spring break beach strip that's packed with revelers and blaring Daft Punk's Get Lucky. If you're 18 and trying to get laid, this is the place to go, observes Stone, who is shadowed by a neatly dressed young man who calls himself Eddie, and whom Stone describes as his aide-de-camp. This isn't Stone's usual watering hole, but it seems like an appropriate stop. It's the site of an anti-mask, pro-Trump rally last April called the Million Maskless March. The tabletops are decorated with sun-bleached photographs of semi-nude spring breakers in rubber Trump mask. As Stone steps to the corner, the bar crowd immediately recognizes the snow-white hair and comic book villain sunglasses, perhaps from cable news, where Stone was last seen, mobbed by TV cameras following his conviction for perjury, obstruction of justice, and threatening a witness in the Robert Mueller investigation. A thin, lantern-jawed young man covered with tattoos emerges from the bar, eager for a picture. "I have a following of a bunch of Republicans who are going to die," he exclaims, posing next to Stone with his phone. He just moved to Florida from Boston, he says, because of the weather and Governor DeSantis. Others come out wide-eyed. A black woman says her mother is a fan, and she wants a photo for proof of celebrity contact. Stone shoots me a victorious look, a black woman who likes a Republican. "Say hello to your mother," he smiles, greeting more fans. "How you doing? How are you?" A few blocks from this bar, Stone informs me, is the home of former Trump campaign guru Brad Parscale, last seen drunk and shirtless and getting tackled by police officers after his wife reported him for acting erratically. Stone claims Parscale, currently advising Caitlyn Jenner on a run for governor in California, is a regular at the Elbow Room. He likes to tell women that he's a professional basketball player, says Stone. Total bullshit, Parscale later tells me. Just then, a drunk guy staggers over, gets in Stone's face, and calls him an old man, infuriating Stone and sparking a brief confrontation that for a moment seems like it's going to spin out of control. Stone's lower teeth are now jutting out like a barracuda's. "I've been boxing for 30 years, he growls. "I hit the heavy bag every weekend for 2 hours. I could have killed him with one shot." The cocktail will have to wait. We retreat to the convertible Camaro I rented for the occasion. And Eddie squeezes into the back seat. "The people who liked me outnumbered those who didn't," Stone says, which is the way it usually is. Behold, Florida, the state that reshaped the conservative vision of America in the age of Trump. Over 4 tumultuous years, the former president turned Florida into the de facto homeland of the GOP, site of the Southern White House, and haloed himself in Floridian allies and courtesans. Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, Palm Beach-based Laura Ingraham, Lou Dobbs, and Ann Coulter, Jupiter-based Mark Levin, Boca Grande-based Tucker Carlson, Palm City-based Dan Bongino, as well as Sean Hannity, who has a condo in Palm Beach, and newly minted Floridian emigre of the right, Ben Shapiro. They come for the weather, to avoid income taxes, and sometimes for Florida's Homestead Act, which shields a house from creditors in the event of bankruptcy. It's also a safe space from liberals. If you're Sean Hannity, you can't walk down the street in Manhattan. You get punched in the face, says Tucker Carlson, who started taping his Fox News show part-time from Florida after protesters came to his house in Washington, D.C. in 2018. But long before Trump, Florida had transformed the modern right, starting with the wrenching battle royale over hanging chads in the 2000 election, the media spectacle that broke the spirit of the previous political age. This was the dawn of Fox News, the Drudge Report, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and Ann Coulter, a loud and belligerent new breed of media pugilist that Beltway observers, old media, used to call the freak show, until the freaks multiplied and the term lost all meaning. Roger Stone was in the vanguard, organizing a group of GOP lawyers and party functionaries dressed in suits to storm a voting center in Miami-Dade County and disrupt the 2000 recount, claiming fraud, in what became known as the Brooks Brothers riot. That stunt established a new threshold for political performance art by turning a dull civic event like vote counting into just another spectacle for cable news. Today, you can buy a baseball cap that declares DeSantis 2024 Make America Florida. Following the Trumpian script, Governor Ron DeSantis, who has made successful political theater of bucking mask mandates and shaming the media, declares that Americans who think like us are coming in droves to the Sunshine State and becoming Republicans. And maybe it's true, though tragedies like the collapse of the Surfside condo in Miami can challenge DeSantis's upbeat visions and expose the rot within. Florida has always been the sunny place for shady people, to quote Roger Stone, quoting Somerset Maugham, the traditional haven of mobsters, drug kingpins, Ponzi schemers, and Joad-like last chancers on the road to salvation or meth addiction. Pablo Escobar had a home here, and Fox News chief Roger Ailes escaped here after News Corp fired him for rampant sexual harassment. Stone's first condo in Key Biscayne was purchased with help from Richard Nixon, who dubbed his own retreat the Florida White House, years before Mar-a-Lago was a twinkle in Trump's eye. This is the state that gave us the Florida Man meme and the rogue weekly National Enquirer, precursor to the paranoid and factually challenged style of Fox News and Newsmax, and a crucial ally in Trump's political ascent. A tabloid state for tabloid people. And now the place is lousy with comers. As Laura Loomer, a friend of Stone's and radical right-wing activist, tells me, every grifter and their mom now wants to move to Florida and establish themselves as the new conservative media network or new conservative publication. It's Wednesday morning in Palm Beach, and the sprinklers hidden in the Augustine lawns are wetting the sidewalks along the hedgerows. Lawrence Lehmer, author of Mar-a-Lago, Inside the Gates of Power at Donald Trump's Presidential Palace, is sitting in his condo across from the ocean, still in his tennis whites. "I've lived here 27 years," he says. "This is the most incredible year I've ever seen. It's a whole generation coming here with money." During the pandemic, waves of one-percenters from Manhattan escaped to Florida and snapped up havens in Miami and Palm Beach. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump prepped a luxury preserve on the private Indian Creek Island, following in the footsteps of Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen. And Sean Hannity bought a condo around the corner from Trump for $5 million. It was an old story, rich New Yorkers escaping to the sunny 6th borough. Back when Trump was still a Page Six B-lister and the Manhattan elite laughed behind his back, he sought a kingdom of his own and found it in the gilded history of Mar-a-Lago, the estate built by serial heiress Marjorie Meriwether Post in 1927. He also imagined himself a version of the real estate baron Henry Flagler, who built a railroad through the Florida swamps in the 19th century and turned Palm Beach into the most desirable resort in America, recounts Lemer, building the biggest hotel in the world on this land and filling it up with these people who come down here and marrying his mistress. That's the classic Palm Beach story. For 4 years, the pecking order in Palm Beach was defined not just by yearly fees to exclusive clubs, but by loyalty to Trump, or at least public silence on the matter. There was the cautionary tale of Lois Pope, a prominent philanthropist and member of Mar-a-Lago, who wrote an op-ed in Time magazine in 2017 expressing disgust with Trump after he suggested the white supremacists in Charlottesville were very fine people. Pope, now 88, relinquished her Mar-a-Lago membership and was iced out by friends. The cancellation of Pope, heir to the National Enquirer fortune, was an ironic twist, given that the source of her wealth is exactly where the story of the Floridization of the right-wing media begins. The history of the tabloid, based in Florida for 42 years, tracks with the rise of populist spectacle and conspiracy theory in right-wing politics, crescendoing with Donald Trump. One afternoon, I drove over to North Palm Beach to see Larry Haley, a craggy 34-year veteran of the Enquirer, who in 1987 published the infamous photo of Senator Gary Hart and model Donna Rice aboard the Monkey Business yacht off Miami that helped torpedo Hart's presidential ambitions. 3 years later, Haley was at Trump Tower, meeting the Donald, a new fixture in the paper's pages. Trump offered his cooperation in turning his bitter divorce from Ivana and affair with Marla Maples into a tabloid storyline. Most of the meeting was him joking around and saying absurd shit about Marla, that her mother's tits were better than Marla's, Haley recalls. We published stories on Trump's affair and divorce, which lasted for many, many issues. They'd fight, they broke up, a constant saga that went on for a long time. Trump and the Enquirer were fated for each other. The tabloid's founder, Generoso Pope Jr., was a childhood friend of Roy Cohn, the Joe McCarthy aide and Nixon lawyer who mentored a young Trump, and Roger Stone in the art of political warfare and media manipulation. Pope called Cohn the smartest man he ever met, and Cohn credited Pope's father, Generoso Pope Sr., a politically connected concrete magnate in New York, with helping get him his start in politics. Pope Jr. bought the original New York Enquirer in the 1950s with money borrowed from a family friend, the mobster Frank Costello, and in 1971 moved to Lantana, Florida, to remake it into the supermarket Bible of UFOs and dubious gossip about Liz Taylor. Like Trump, Pope Jr. grew up in privilege, but thumbed his nose at the Manhattan elite, preferring instead to titillate the lumpen proletariat with a garish melange of scandal, nostalgia, miracle diets, and right-wing patriotism. At its peak in the 1980s, the Enquirer reached 4.7 million readers. When Pope died in 1988, Haley went to his house in Manalapka, Florida, and viewed the Spartan bedroom, a single bed, a big screen TV, and shelves groaning with VHS tapes of Hogan's Heroes and Gilligan's Island. This is where his head was at, which is pretty much where our readers' heads were at, he says. That same year, Stone, in an interview on C-SPAN, argued that Trump, whom Stone met in 1979 through Cohn, would be a credible candidate for President of the United States. What you don't understand, Stone recalls saying, is the political world and the pop culture worlds have fused. It's all entertainment. In the 1990s, Haley was a guest at Trump's Mar-a-Lago parties, and Trump became a regular Inquirer source, tipping off the paper when Michael Jackson was coming to the property for a rendezvous with Lisa Marie Presley, or inviting Haley to his wedding to Maples so the Inquirer could cover it. "We got an exclusive first picture of the baby," says Haley. "It was Tiffany Trump." Trump, meanwhile, was learning from the Inquirer how to communicate with a mass audience. "We taught Donald Trump how to talk in buzzwords," Haley explains. "He was a good student. He paid attention. I was amazed how much attention he paid, because I didn't have a strong sense of that at the time, except that he seemed amused by it. But he was looking for a way to use buzzwords to get the attention of our readers." The Inquirer's interest in politics was mainly of the salacious variety, the Hart affair, or the revelation in 1996 that Stone and his wife were swingers, which got Stone fired from Bob Dole's presidential campaign and thrust him into the world of behind-the-scenes politicking. Then came the big kahuna, Bill Clinton's affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky, the virtual genesis story of the modern right. The Inquirer went full court press, splashing Lewinsky on the cover. "Monica's story, I just wanted Bill to love me." And sloganizing a new philosophy, these days celebrities are politicians, and politicians are celebrities. Next photos, right-wing tour. Ann Coulter helped forge a new media style before being cast out of Trumpland. And it's a war. Toni Holt Kramer and her fellow Donald-loving Trumpettes. The Clinton affair set the table for the mega-spectacle of the 2000 presidential election, when for 5 solid weeks, Florida and its hanging chads became the white-hot center of the American political universe. By the time the Supreme Court ruled in favor of George W. Bush over Al Gore, NBC's Tim Russert had popularized the concept of red and blue states. Fox News had turned conservative distrust of the media into a game-changing brand of hyper-partisanship, and Florida was a byword for quadrennial political cliffhangers. Around this time, David Pecker, a pal of Trump's from Manhattan, became the CEO of Inquirer parent company American Media and moved the tabloid to Boca Raton. Pecker began holding board meetings at Mar-a-Lago and supported Trump's first attempt to run for president in 2000 on the Reform Party ticket. By 2010, the tabloid started claiming Barack Obama wasn't an American citizen. "Barack Obama, Kenyan birth certificate exposed," right as Trump was road-testing the racist conspiracy as a political attack. 6 years later, the Inquirer published an endorsement of Trump for president, a first for the tabloid. Behind closed doors, the relationship was hand in glove in ways no one yet knew. Pecker's Inquirer was buying exclusive stories from Trump's alleged mistresses and burying them in advance of the 2016 election, the infamous catch-and-kill strategy. The Inquirer pulled up stakes in Florida in 2014, but its tabloid DNA, the conspiracy theories and bogus and serialized claims about celebrities, embedded in a nostalgic, commercialized jingoism, had now migrated wholesale to the conservative media. Instead of obsessing over the travails of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, the tabloid right obsessed over Barack Obama as a secret Muslim or Joe Biden as a socialist puppet for a cabal of radical feminists. Nowhere was this tabloid conversion more evident than in Newsmax, the right-wing media company founded by Chris Ruddy, who had made his name questioning the suicide of White House counsel Vince Foster, feeding the conspiracy theory that the Clintons were somehow involved. Fresh off a book on the subject, Ruddy moved to West Palm Beach from New York in 1998 and started Newsmax with backing from right-wing financier Richard Mellon Skaife, hoping to build a conservative media empire and take the company public. Ruddy's media menu included a healthy dose of right-wing conspiracy, including Trump's favorite, Obama's birth certificate. Ruddy loves conspiracy theories, says a former Newsmax employee. They're great for hysteria in the media. He also loves psychics and predictions of stuff. Ruddy mined the National Enquirer for hires, recruiting veteran editor Steve Kaz to run Newsmax editorial. Meanwhile, he knocked around Mar-a-Lago trying to meet powerful people and launched Newsmax TV. By 2016, Trump was running for the GOP nomination, but Ruddy initially backed Ted Cruz. I remember in 2016 being at Trump International Golf Club for a Sunday brunch and sitting at this table with Chris, says Lemur, a former social friend. And Trump comes over and Chris didn't even want to talk to him because Trump wanted Chris to turn Newsmax pro-Trump, and Ruddy felt that Trump was a psychopath. Ruddy declined to comment on the record. Ruddy became a full-time Trump functionary, cashing in on the demand for pro-Trump news, building up his TV network, dining with Trump at Mar-a-Lago, and watching his revenue rise. He made his pact with the devil, as Lemur put it. He knew what Trump was. Newsmax went all in as Trump sought re-election. Ruddy made another former National Enquirer editor, David Perel, the editorial director, and Newsmax TV gave credence to every lie told by Trump up to and including speculation that Biden was cognitively impaired and that the election was stolen through chicanery involving Dominion voting systems. While the January 6th Capitol riots were underway, Newsmax initially reported that it was only 6 to 10 people breaching the building and speculating that they were Antifa, later providing uncritical airtime to a Trump rioter who declared, "This is our house, and we have the right to be here." In recent years, Ruddy has expressed regret for overzealous attacks on Bill Clinton in the 1990s, personally reconciling with the former president and donating $1 million to his foundation. One might presume his regret extended to spreading conspiracy theories like the Vince Foster canard, but business is business, and Ruddy merely moved on to other fake stories, giving voluminous airtime and ink, even after the insurrection, to stolen election conspiracy mongers Mike Lindell, the MyPillow founder, and former Trump lawyer Rudolph Giuliani. The week that I'm in Florida, the Inquirer cover on newsstands is virtually indistinguishable from Newsmax, promising the truth about Joe Biden's health. "Okay, slow down," instructs Ann Coulter. "We're coming to it now. On the left is going to be Bernie Madoff's old house." We're in the Camaro for what Coulter is calling my right-wing tour of Palm Beach, pointing out the homes of various conservative heroes, liberal enemies, and notorious scoundrels. At 59, she's bone-thin in a sporty white dress and tennis visor. "I almost wore Lily Pulitzer for you," she says, referring to the preppy dressmaker. "Honestly, I'm from New Canaan. I just always thought that's what people wore." We begin in front of O'Bar, where William Kennedy Smith met the woman he was later acquitted of raping in the controversial and much-televised trial in 1991, a classic tale of Kennedy family privilege that that still tickles Coulter. The proprietors came in, waved the incense, had an exorcism, and now it's a great restaurant, she says. Coulter was triggering libs before Twitter was even invented. As we cruise by the late Roger Ailes' house, she sprays her thighs with sunscreen and tells the story of how she got her start as a conservative commentator on the fledgling MSNBC in 1996. A supporter of Pitchfork Pat Buchanan, the stridently xenophobic arch-nationalist who was running for president that year, her on-air mantra was, "Go, Pat, go." It was the early days of the internet, and she recalls reading a new site called The Drudge Report, which was just that tiny little blog out of Hollywood, she says. And out of the blue, Drudge sends me an email saying nothing but, "Go, Pat, go." Coulter and Drudge met in person while the two were in Washington to support the long-shot candidate. "We went to Pat Buchanan's first presidential launch party at his house," she recalls, "and we were sort of inseparable, but it wasn't just ideological. When Drudge broke the story of Clinton's White House affair on his primitive website in 1998, he breathed life into a nascent cable and internet-driven conservative media, but also ruptured the wall between the legitimate press and the tabloids, regularly linking to the Inquirer and later Alex Jones's InfoWars. Newly rich and famous, Drudge moved to Miami with his pet cat, bought a beachfront condo on Collins Avenue, and began operating the website from a yellow Mustang convertible. At Drudge's urging, Coulter moved to Miami and took up residence in the same building. They became attached at the hip. We created something nobody had done before, and nobody thought it would work," Coulter says. The two were giddy with newfound success. Coulter gave Drudge his first taste of alcohol on a flight from California. On another trip, sitting in first class, Drudge looked at Coulter's stack of the New York Times and said, "You're not going to learn anything from that." She looked over. Drudge was reading the National Enquirer. According to a former Inquirer reporter, Drudge sometimes socialized and traded gossip with the staff at a South Palm Beach motel called the Hawaiian. "We pass a cobbled driveway dotted with American flags and sun-faded pictures memorializing the address's late owner, Rush Limbaugh." Coulter points to the service entrance, where she and Drudge would enter Limbaugh's 34,000-square-foot estate to avoid being seen and have regular dinner parties, drinking 800 bottles of wine as their host puffed on Cuban cigars. This went on for years. In 2005, Coulter bought a Palm Beach property and took up the clubby lifestyle. "All the parties here take place in private," she says. From a distance, we see the Breakers Hotel, where Roy Cohn spent some of his last days watching the ocean while dying of the AIDS virus he denied having. "I loved Roy Cohn," she says of the political fixer, whose first job for Trump in 1973 was defending his practice of barring black people from his rental properties. "I wish I could have met him." Coulter was a regular reader of the New York Post and thought Trump was a doofus. But a funny thing happened. In December 2014, Drudge came to her house to ring in the new year. Just the two of them, and came up with the title of Coulter's latest book, Adios America, The Left's Plan to Turn Our Country into a Third World Hellhole, Her Diatribe Against Illegal Immigration. To stir up outrage, Coulter promoted the book in an interview with prominent Mexican-American anchor Jorge Ramos on Fusion, the Hispanic media channel, and compared Mexican immigrants to ISIS terrorists. "If you don't want to be killed by a Mexican, there's nothing I can tell you," she said. Drudge splashed the headline on his site, and Trump's campaign requested a copy of the book the same day. Then Trump appeared to use it as the basis of his first speech as a candidate at Trump Tower. I mean, I pushed the whole Mexican rapist thing, but I put it a lot better than Trump did, Coulter says. After Trump won the election, Coulter began a regular correspondence with his advisor, Corey Lewandowski, and occasionally saw her private opinions spring up in Trump's public commentary. Coulter felt she was having some influence. But the worm turned in 2019. "I was flying back down to Florida that day from New York," recounts Coulter. "I see on the Drudge Report, no wall funding, and I'm just rip shit." Feeling betrayed, she whipped off a tweet calling Trump a disloyal actual retard. Drudge followed soon after, pivoting his site to become critical of Trump, who noticed the shift and claimed that Drudge had experienced a nervous breakdown and sold out. Drudge has become a Howard Hughes-like figure in recent years, rarely seen in public. When a Florida reporter named Bob Norman tried knocking on his door last year, Drudge freaked out and threatened to call the police. Norman said he just wanted to know Drudge's views on Trump, to which Drudge replied, "You and everybody else." Coulter, who remains in touch with Drudge, suggests that he, like herself, was simply angry over Trump's broken promises on the wall funding. With Drudge silent, he did not respond to multiple interview requests for this story. Rumors have flowered as the site continues to batter Trump over his presidency and the January 6th storming of the Capitol. One theory has it that Jared Kushner personally offended Drudge. Another suggests Drudge sold the website to some investors in advance of the 2020 election, and his silence was a way to keep up the ruse. Ann Coulter has lost traction in the Trumpified media, her failure to pledge total fealty making her persona non grata. The style she helped create had long since run amok and morphed into something else, an entire industry of partisan carnival barkers on cable and talk radio who cashed in on what Coulter and her pals pioneered. Before he died of cancer earlier this year, Limbaugh, a Trump supporter through and through, privately expressed contempt for Sean Hannity and Mark Levin, calling them imitators who copied his act but with half the wit and even less of the intellect, his opinion no doubt complicated by the fact that Limbaugh's brother, David, is Hannity's agent. In the Trump era, whatever thin line had existed between the political parties and their media mouthpieces was long ago erased. Coulter directs my gaze above the hedgerows, that hideous, way-too-big American flag that looks like a car dealership is Mar-a-Lago, she says. I ask her if she bears any responsibility for helping invent the hyperpartisan atmosphere that has, over 20 years, drowned America in a toxic stew of perpetual outrage and tabloid paranoia. She considers this a moment. No, she says, because I made it fun. I don't think I was mean-spirited. I mean, give me the quote and I'll defend it. You can make funny jokes about politicians. They're politicians. People are out there in the public. They make fun of me. I make fun of them. They were funny. They were lighthearted. But there was always a point behind it. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.